Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the intensifying argument over the Russian hacking of our recent election following a lengthy investigation by the New York Times, and speak with an expert on cyber espionage and cyber warfare, Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. He joins us to discuss the question of intent on the part of Putin, since there is no doubt that Russia hacked the election. But there are different conclusions coming from the CIA, who believe that Putin's intent was to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, while the FBI is less certain about that, but are certain that Russia did the hacking. We will assess the political spin, with the Republicans in denial and Trump claiming the CIA has become politicized, while Democrats can certainly argue the FBI has become politicized since the FBI's director, James Comey, clearly swung the election in Trump's favor. Then we'll speak with Lisa Graves, the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org and PR Watch. She joins us to discuss the extent to which Donald Trump's cabinet is the Koch brothers' dream come true, since it is stacked with global warming deniers who represent the coal, oil, and gas extractive interests. And since David Koch celebrated Donald Trump's victory on election night in Trump Tower with him, perhaps the alleged distance between them and their agendas was a piece of theater aimed at making working-class voters think that Trump cared more about them and not his fellow plutocrat. Then finally, with today's raising of interest rates by the Fed, we will speak with economist Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and the author of Rigged: How Globalism and the Rules of the Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. He joins us to discuss whether this is the beginning of a trend that could lead to a recession, and whether at today's meeting with the Silicon Valley titans, Trump promised a sweetheart deal to repatriate capital stashed abroad in exchange for a one-time, favorably low tax rate. And joining us now is Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books and articles, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, and Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also the author of Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next World War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Singer.
Thanks for having me.
And it's obviously this Russian hacking has become a political story, and we're told that from the Washington Post recently that there was a briefing back in September of the top 12 Republicans and Democrats in the House, Senate, and on the Intelligence and Homeland Security Committees, yet they couldn't come to a consensus to alert the American public about it, and it's become partisan with the Republicans not wanting the information out or certainly any suggestions of a link between Putin and Trump. And on the other hand, you've got Harry Reid out there sort of castigating the press to stop this he said, she said nonsense and look into this. So the people who've seen this CIA information seem to think it's pretty explosive. Is it ever going to see the light of day, do you think?
I certainly hope it does. This is obviously an incredibly important moment in not just the story of this election, but the story of American democracy writ large. This is arguably the most important hack ever, most potentially influential. And, you know, this is something that certainly merits, I would argue, not just the hearings that we're talking about, which gets it funneled through a partisan lens, like what we saw, you know, play out, for example, with Benghazi, but instead, you know, treat it like, for example, the 9/11 Commission, create a bipartisan group of experts trusted by both sides, give them the leeway to investigate it. You know, the names that have been floated for the kind of people that would be apt for it are, you know, Panetta, Bob Gates, Mike Hayden, people that are trusted across the aisle. And, you know, let's look at this. I would add, though, you know, the key here is not whether the hack happened. The debate is also not whether Russia did it. The debate between the CIA and the FBI and what played out within those congressional meetings was the intent. So it was not whether the crime happened. The debate's not whether who did the crime. It's why. With one group saying that it was a classic information warfare campaign, just targeting Detroit and, create distrust in American democracy writ large, to sort of damage the governing system. The other is the argument put forward by the CIA that says we've got added evidence that shows that it was intended to help Donald Trump. So again, this has been something that's sort of, confusing to people, but it's really quite simple. There's not a debate about the hack. There is a wide agreement, both within the intelligence community, within law enforcement, within the cybersecurity industry, that Russia was behind this. Let me be clear on the cybersecurity industry part, because I think that's very critical here. There are multiple different companies. In fact, five different companies have identified this as being a state, a Russian state-linked attack towards the DNC. The fact that it's not just one company, but multiple different companies that, they're competitors. They like nothing more than to disagree with each other, than to sort of show up the other's work. And yet all of them, CrowdStrike, Fidelis, Mandiant, SecureWorks, these are the, some of the top companies out there. They all concluded this way back in summer.
Well, that's what's extraordinary, though, is that the information has been out there since summer. These companies aren't political. They're not biased. They're tech companies. They're very competitive amongst each other. So if anybody comes up with anything that's remotely debatable or false, they'll be pounced on. So my sense is, and I don't think I'm getting partisan here, is that throughout this whole, these several months of this campaign, most of the denials have been coming from Donald Trump himself, who's tried to laugh it all off and said that some fat kid in a room in New Jersey is doing it.
We need to be clear, yes. There are people that deny. First, they said the hack didn't happen. They've also said, no, Russia was not behind it. Those individuals include Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, and Julian Assange. Again, so that's one side of the argument. The other side of the argument is multiple different cybersecurity companies, the actual experts, the people that don't call it the cyber, as well as the intelligence community and FBI. Again, the debate right now, why this is making the news, is not the high confidence that the Russian government did it. That was put out there back in October. The debate now is the intent, whether it was intended to help one side or another. And so the CIA's argument is pointing to, for example, things like the fact that that leaks were only came out from one side in terms of you didn't see the RNC and embarrassing secrets by that put out there. I'd like to joke about this coming from the cybersecurity field that, if the RNC has somehow been the one political institution that managed to fight off all of these cyber attacks, it really should share its secret with the rest of us of why it alone is so good at this. I mean, sort of on face value, it falls apart. One of the other sort of funny things that is a good illustration of where we're at here is there was, for example, a cover story claim early on in this breach that, it was a Romanian hacker called Guccifer 2.0 that did it. That cover story got quickly debunked when a reporter from Motherboard, a tech journal, did an interview with him, an online interview, and switched over into Romanian during the interview. And the supposed Romanian hacker could only reply back clearly using auto-translate. So, the point of all this, again, is to – it seems very complex to people, but it is quite simple. It's not whether there was a hack. It's not – the debates move past, at least among serious people, whether Russia was behind it. It's the intent. And then you can, have a debate about that.
Well, clearly that's explosive politically, isn't it? If you had proof that there's been that at least Vladimir Putin tipped the scales to get Trump elected, whether Trump was there's any complicity or back channel, there have been rumors about that. We don't know, but that in itself is explosive. But what explains, for example, for the months now, because I've been trying to cover this story, I've been getting angry emails from listeners who obviously watched the Russian channel RT and believe what Putin's putting out there. You know, they're saying, where's the proof? Where's the proof? You're a front for the Ukrainian fascists and all this kind of insane stuff. What explains, I can understand why the Republicans don't want this investigated, this link between Putin and Trump, but what's your explanation for that kind of residual knee-jerk distrust that is out there?
Well, there's a couple of things wrapped up into what you said. The first is, you know, whether it actually swung the election or not. And that's not a cybersecurity question. That's a question in terms of, you know, polling and the political science side. And, you know, my answer to that would be in an election that's so close when you're talking about something that really turned on about 100,000 voters in three states, all sorts of things weighed in. So, you know, this, I think, obviously weighed in, obviously the impact of FBI Comey letter. But that doesn't mean that, for example, Hillary didn't make her campaign didn't make strategic mistakes, you know, for example, not putting out as many ads in Michigan or whatnot. You know, when you're talking about such a close election, all sorts of things weighed in, all sorts of reasons weighed in. But then you get to the question of, okay, what's going on here in terms of Russian information warfare and influence operations? And this feels very new to Americans, but it's actually an old playbook. It's a playbook that was actually first developed back in the 1940s in the old Soviet Union. It's classic information warfare where you're using information itself as a weapon, and you're not trying to make the other side love you. You're rather trying to create distrust and disarray. You're trying to make people, in fact, distrust anything and everything. And that approach, now using cyber means, including particularly the cross of hacking and social media, it again feels new to Americans, but this sort of cyber side of it and the dumping of embarrassing secrets, it's happened to Russian opposition parties. It happened in the Ukrainian election. It happened in the Hungarian election. It's the head of MI6 in the UK recently pointed to Britain being under siege on that. And what's interesting to people who monitor this is after our election, many of these same resources, including, for example, the, you know, kind of troll factories, the online, you know, personas that act like they're American, but you can track them back to being based in Russia. Many of them pivoted, and now they're focusing on Germany and their upcoming election. So, you know, again, in this space, it's a very effective, it's particularly effective against open societies, but it's all the more empowered in this world of social media that we have right now where people kind of don't know what to trust, and so they distrust everything. And we, you know, the danger of this is that it's not just, you know, a foreign influence on an election, but it leaves democracy itself weakened. Which, oh, by the way, is the point of an autocratic leader like Putin.
Well, indeed, and you can take that further by suggesting that perhaps the motive is to get Donald Trump elected, not necessarily because he's the Manchurian candidate, as some people have suggested, but that he will simply make America, not make America great again, but weaken America, which does appear to be in the cards here because of we're such a divided nation, and this issue is hardly healing the wounds. Now, just in the last minute or so,
again, that's the debate. You know, that won't be answered by the forensics of the hack. That's more answered by, you know, an investigation and what are your other resources bringing to bear? Are you, you know, for example, a key difference between the FBI and the CIA is human intelligence and other sources, intercepts and the like. But my point is to you is, again, you know, you laid out sort of a conclusion from it. I'm trying to be very kind of calm and rational and say, you know, we don't know. That's, you know, that is the question of the intent of the perpetrator. That's not something that we know right now. What we do know is that, you know, the overwhelming evidence and multiple trusted sources all point to a Russian role.
Right, but since you've, Peter Singh, have you written about future wars with the novel Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war, and you've written Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, when the former deputy director and acting director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, says that the Russian hacking of our election is the cyber equivalent of 9/11, then whatever you think of that, the point I'd like to make is that, just in closing, is that this is just information warfare, which is bad enough in itself to influence an election. But the same means could actually shut our country down. It could attack our grid. It could attack all of our infrastructure, couldn't it? In other words, the Russians have demonstrated that they can penetrate America in a deep and profound way.
We are in a very different world, both because of the fact of how much of our way of life, our business, communications networks, military systems, and the like have moved online, and that gives us incredible new capabilities, but also new vulnerabilities. But we're also in a whole new world, and the question now is not a what if. What if there was, as you put it, a cyber 9/11 style takedown of the power grid or the like? That's a future question. There is a already happened. The already happened was an attack on American political institutions, an attack on American democracy itself. It already happened. So the question is, how are we going to respond? So far, we have responded in a way that I find sad. We've responded in an utterly partisan manner where, you know, the groups looked at it and said, how can this be to my advantage as, you know, one party or another? And that is a recipe for long-term insecurity. It's an insecurity in terms of kind of a thinking of this in, you know, like a classic national security realm, but insecurity in terms of our mentality as a nation. So again, you know, the issue now is not a what might happen in the future. We've just gone through arguably the most important cyber attack in history, at least in terms of the weight of its impact and the significance of its target. It happened. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to look away and act like it didn't happen?
Well, Peter Singer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks very much.
And I've been speaking with Peter Singer, who's a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of several books and articles, including Corporate Warriors, The Rise of the Privatized Military Industry, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century, and Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also the author of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into whether Trump's cabinet is the Koch brothers' dream come true.
I'd like to buy the Coke, the world, so they'd leave us alone. Then go back to Park Avenue and crawl beneath their stone.
I'd like to teach the Cokes about a true democracy. Where working class takes corporate ass, proceed to shining.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And the work that you've done over the years, Lisa, on ALEC Exposed, of course, one of the big funders of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has been the Koch brothers, if not the creators of the very confluence between big corporations and state governments that has really, I think, led to the capture of most of the state legislatures across the country by the Republicans starting in 2010. But now they've captured the entire government. They've got the judiciary, they've got the House, the Senate, and in a matter of weeks, they'll have the White House. But my sense is that as I look at this cabinet being formed, that it's almost like this is the Koch brothers' dream cabinet. It's almost like the Koch brothers are putting together this cabinet full of global warming deniers, fossil fuel champions, pipeline oil and gas extraction people, and they've even gone as far as to try and purge the Department of Energy of anybody within the DOE that worked on climate change issues and global warming. So this feels to me like the Koch brothers' cabinet.
It feels a bit like the Koch brothers' coup, actually. But I think on the one hand, you have the public statements of Charles Koch about not endorsing Trump. And on the other hand, you have what we've documented on our PR Watch site, which is millions and millions and millions of dollars going into the Senate races in swing states to get out the vote through their America's Prosperity Operation and other activities like Libre and more. And so I think you can see how much the Koch activity in the states really buoyed or lifted up Trump in a number of states other than Nevada. And I think you can also take some knowledge from the fact that David Koch was apparently celebrating with Trump the night of the election. And so I think on the one hand, there's a bit of the optics that have gone on that have been reported in the press. And then there's a bit more about what happens on the ground and where there is allegiance. And certainly Trump has embraced the Koch agenda on energy, and what that means for the rest of us is a Department of Energy and a Department of Interior and a EPA, potentially, depending on who ultimately gets in, but certainly in the details, that is hostile to doing anything about climate change, that's going to attempt to take the fangs out of the EPA and its ability to protect our water and our air. You see potentially efforts by some of these Koch-trained operatives, people who've been in Koch-funded organizations that are now in leadership roles, potentially their effort to try to preempt state powers in this area, for example, in California. I think they have a very far-reaching agenda that they call a free market agenda. I call it free market fundamentalism, and what it really is at odds with genuine democracy in this country where people have the ability to regulate corporations like Koch Industries and the oil industry.
So is it then possible that the Koch brothers were doing a little sort of kabuki dance with Donald Trump, pretending that they were at odds with him while funding on the ground, not necessarily directly funding him, but if the fact that David Koch celebrated election night victory with Donald Trump is pretty telling in itself. My sense is that the real connection to the Kochs, and there may well be an equally deep one with Donald Trump, it's just that they've tried to distance themselves or at least give the appearance of that. The real deep connection, I understand, is between the Kochs and the Vice President, Mike Pence.
Well, I think what we know from the evidence that's out there is that Mike Pence has carried forward the Koch agenda in Indiana. We know that Mike Pence hired Mark Short, M-A-R-C Short, who was previously the head of the Koch Brothers Freedom Partners operation that arose, that was launched in 2012. And Mark Short left Freedom Partners earlier this year to help Marco Rubio, And then when Marco Rubio flamed out, he was ultimately hired by Mike Pence to be his communications director. So you basically have one of the top Koch operatives in the country, one of the leading Kochites, basically, as one of the top advisors to Mike Pence, who has been a willing shill, in my opinion, for the Koch agenda for many years in his various capacities. And so you certainly have an enormous amount of Koch influence on him. But more than that, I think you have a president-elect who has basically decided to embrace the oil and coal and fracking industry in an unmitigated way, and in doing so has basically turned over the keys to the kingdom to the Koch operatives in these different think tanks or operations in D.C. Basically the swamp of the corporate lobbyists have taken over. And then you see Trump naming Exxon to be the head of the State Department, to be the nation's top diplomat, which is an astounding, outrageous, outlandish proposal, one that the head of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, who I've been calling Rexxon lately, he's not qualified for. He has no experience in public diplomacy. He's never been a diplomat. What he's done is cut deals for Exxon, including pursue a major deal with Putin in Russia for Arctic exploration and production of gas in the Arctic, which would only further fuel the global warming crisis, the climate change crisis that scientists around the world agree is happening and that most Americans understand is happening and want something to be done about. And so I think we have a enormous crisis on our hands with Trump being so obsequious to the oil interests. And interestingly, one of the things I thought at the time was that Trump, of course, claimed that he wasn't going to be the Koch's puppet, even though obviously he in many ways is. But I think that the Kochs were concerned that he wouldn't be enough of a puppet for them, and it turns out that he is. And so, he is more than happy to turn over the devil in the details to the devils, basically, for lack of a better term, in terms of the guys who have been trying to kill the international climate agreements, who've been trying to kill the regulation of carbon by the EPA, who've been trying to kill a number of measures that help promote solar energy and alternative energy in the U.S. These guys are now in the driver's seat.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of alecexposed.org and PR Watch. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. So again, it does feel like the Koch brothers cabinet. I mean, you have in the most extraordinary collection of global warming deniers. You've got, the guy that they've nominated for the Department of Interior is, he's not an outright denier, but he's on the fence. I don't know how anybody could be on the fence, frankly. You've got the head of now Department of Energy, former governor from Texas, who couldn't remember which of the three departments he wanted to abolish, one of which was the Department of Energy. And he is a global warming denier. You've got Trump himself, a global warming denier. You've got the appointment to the EPA as a global warming denier. I think the commerce guy is also a global warming denier, isn't he? How many more? And then even though the Secretary of State nominee may not be a global warming denier, he's out there to get as much fossil fuel out of the ground as possible around the world, and him and Putin are going to work together to do that. So all in all, can you kiss the planet goodbye?
I think it's a total disaster. I think that you have a situation, like you point out, where some of them claim they're not climate change deniers. They instead are claiming it's uncertain. That's the more sophisticated form of climate change denial. They want to say it's not certain. It's not certain that it's happening or how fast or what we need to do about it. All of that is a bit of a ruse. Has been well documented in books like Merchants of Doubt and the film and more. This is their tactic. The tactic is to try to sow seeds of doubt, to try to sow claims of uncertainty, to try to stop any efforts to address climate change in any meaningful way. And these are crucial years for our planet. These are crucial years for our nation to be addressing climate change in a responsible way, like a responsible country would do. And instead you have a president-elect who is doing the bidding of the oil industry, apparently doing the bidding of Putin, and who basically, I don't know where he gets his news. It doesn't appear to be from real news sources. He's not even really getting intelligence briefings, it appears. He's basically relying on, the right-wing fake news machine for his information, and he either believes or cynically is willing to claim that climate change isn't happening and to promote myths about it, but beyond just his rhetoric, to actually put people in positions of power who have done everything they can, or basically professional opponents of climate change, well-paid professional opponents of doing something about climate change, including Tillerson. You know, the fact that Exxon as a company has done some investment in alternative energy, and he has claimed to not be a, quote, denier, doesn't mean that they haven't put their weight in many ways, and certainly over the years, behind climate change denial. In fact, we filed a complaint with the IRS right before the election against Exxon for its efforts to use the American Legislative Exchange Council as a vehicle to advance its efforts to obstruct any measures to address climate change, as well as to make it harder to subsidize the alternative energy industry to help promote alternatives to fossil fuels. So it's a terrible crisis. It's a disaster. And in many ways, it's a worse disaster than the people who were afraid that Trump would win, you know, feared, because I don't think any of us had the creative imagination to even dream that someone would have the audacity to appoint someone so manifestly unqualified and conflicted as the head of Exxon to be our top diplomat. Not ever in the wildest fears or nightmares was that the case. And they claim that you don't need experience for that job. Well, then, you know, hire me to lead Exxon. I have a lot of ideas on what it could do differently. And I don't have any experience. I have just as much experience running Exxon as Rex Tillerson has experience running the State Department.
Well, then how, Lisa Graves, do you explain, given this horrible collection of global warming deniers, people who are deeply hostile to even the concept that global warming and climate change is happening, even though it's manifestly clear and it won't be long before Donald Trump's estate down there in Palm Beach has, you know, waves lapping into the front porch. But why then did he meet with Al Gore and then Leo DiCaprio? Is that some form of cynical humiliation on their part? While he, you know, one day he meets with Al Gore, and the next day he puts a global warming denier in charge of the EPA?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that anyone who has observed Trump, and I'm not a paid psychologist, I'm not a trained psychologist, but I think from a layperson standpoint, it's clear that Donald Trump is a deeply insecure person who wants people to pay homage to him, to kiss up to him, to suck up to him, and he takes offense easily. And so I think he was more than willing to have Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio come and try to persuade him or pretend that he could be persuaded on these issues and get the publicity of their meeting with him and then turn around and diss them. It's part of his modus operandi in some ways is to try to dangle these opportunities or potentials before people, whether it's someone like Mitt Romney or someone like Al Gore, and yet he's already, in essence, chosen a different course or leaning toward a different course, one that in some ways is humiliating. I think on the part of the people who, like Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio, who have tried to reach out to him, I think that's a well-intentioned effort to try to avert this crisis, to try to speak some sense to Donald Trump. I don't think that Donald Trump is someone who listens to anyone, really. He's someone who claims that he's the smartest guy in the room, and he has, quote, a good brain, and he doesn't need to listen to other people. He doesn't really care about facts. And so I think it's extremely, extremely troubling to have someone who is so unreflective, so self-oriented, such an egomaniac in this enormously powerful position in our country and our world. And, you know, I think people have to continue to try to convince him, to persuade him on issues, but I don't have a lot of hope that he is persuadable by anyone other than the right-wing fringe that he listens to.
Well, what do you think happened today in the meeting with the Silicon Valley titans? I mean, he already met yesterday with Bill Gates, and Bill Gates has put together a $1 billion fund to deal with global warming. Most of those Silicon Valley people, I don't know about Peter Thiel, his buddy, but the rest of them seem to be pretty clear about global warming and as concerned as any sentient person ought to be. So you just think he thinks he's smarter than all those people, and this, once again, this is just the mountain coming to Muhammad.
Well, I fear that that's the case. I mean, hope springs eternal. I hope that someone could break through, you know, touch his heart, really persuade him that that the lies he's been spewing are in fact lies or myths, and that he's been misled, and that he needs to get on the right side of this issue. In fact, you know, in some sort of unusual irony, I don't know if irony is the right term, but Putin even has, you know, stated that that climate change is happening, and maybe Putin could persuade him, I don't know, in this bizarro land that we now live in. I hope that the Silicon Valley billionaires who understand what's happening to our planet are persuasive. You know, I think that on the other hand, you have Trump embracing the free market fundamentalism of the Koch brothers, which is this completely discredited idea that the free market is going to somehow solve all of our problems and put our interests first. The nature of the corporation, the very essence of the corporation, is to maximize profit to the extent legally possible. And here you have the people who have been defending corporate interests, corporate so-called rights, being put into the position of making law, of remaking regulations, of basically trying to urge the defunding of core activities to address climate change, to try to change the law to benefit those corporations. I don't think there's any sign that the corporations, without the power of the state, without the power of a vibrant and healthy democracy, would take action to address climate change, particularly some of these big oil and gas and coal companies who are getting richer and richer every single year by trying to thwart all efforts to address climate change. We actually documented how some of these key lobbyists have met with the state attorneys general, the Republican state attorneys general, to try to push efforts to kill the Clean Power Plan. You know, paid big money. Some of these corporations paid huge sums to have a meeting with these state Republican attorneys general to advance that agenda, and some of them have paid big money to basically influence the results of our election at every level, from the president on through to all the other legislative positions. And so, you know, to the extent that Trump may possibly, I guess, pivot to some sort of free market analysis that somehow the free market will solve this, I think it's been proven over and over again to be a false premise. But that's the sort of premise that the Koch brothers have infused into the political infrastructure through their billions of dollars that they have made and the millions and millions they spent to create the basically the ecosphere that Koch and the people who advise him swim in.
Well, but proactively, though, it's not just that they deny global warming. They want to eliminate the evidence that's existing.
Yeah.
Now you have people trying to download all of the EPA's material and all their research just to protect it from Trump when he comes in. His transition team already asked for a list of the names of anybody in the Department of Energy that had worked on Obama's Clean Power Plan and on issues involving global warming. And fortunately, the DOE told them to get lost. It's absolute McCarthyism that's going on here. So if they're already trying to have a witch hunt before they even get into office, I imagine when they get into office, aren't they going to have a witch hunt?
Well, I think it's actually terrifying from the standpoint of science and democracy and civil service and the whole notion of what's in the public interest, the public's interest versus these private narrow interests that these people are pursuing. You know, this afternoon, the Trump campaign or the Trump transition team disavowed the effort to get this information, of course, a couple days after it happened. And they claimed that the guy who did it got a stern talking to, wasn't fired, wasn't let go, nothing like that. And so, you know, this in some ways, it's more manipulation of the press and public by the Trump team. The fact is that that, in fact, happened, and a lot of people have serious concerns that more will happen when they come into actual power. Certainly, we saw shadows of that, shades of that, and activities by the Bush administration to crush science, to try to minimize real science that was contrary to industry's interests. You know, there were hearings on the Hill about those activities, but I think the Trump administration's the Trump administration to B's approach is that on steroids. It is, I think, a very fearful period in our country that we are entering with him and the people he's chosen, including even having someone like Jeff Sessions potentially become the Attorney General of the United States, someone who, you know, whose judgment has been wrong on most things. But because he's, I suppose, blessed to be from Alabama, he's been reelected over and over and over again. You know, he'll be in charge of the Justice Department. Will they be pursuing his agenda against people based on their religion, based on their country of origin, based on their beliefs? We don't know, but I think we have to find a way to stand up and speak out and fight back and stand together against this sort of authoritarianism that we see in the we saw budding through the campaign and that we see manifesting in some ways through some of these choices now.
Well, just in closing, Lisa Graves, given that Mike Pence, it's possible that Mike Pence may do a lot of the running of the country and that Trump sees himself as the showman in charge and just to keep the shareholders happy until they figure out they've been had. And he likes the as you say, the ego stroking and the spectacle, and he'll do government by stunt, which is what he started to do with Carrier. He has a stunt in Indiana, and he has another stunt at Trump Tower with a little Japanese guy saying that he's going to invest $50 billion and create 55,000 jobs, this kind of stuff. They're all stunts. That's what we may be subjected to, but meanwhile, the heavy lifting is going to be done by Mike Pence, who's close to the Kochs. And this is, just in closing, the point I want to make, Lisa, is that as much as we can be appalled at Donald Trump, the real cynical ones are the ones that are using Donald Trump to enact their agenda, which are the Koch brothers and all of these characters, whether it's Mitch McConnell, whether it's Paul Ryan, whether it's Mike Pence, you name it. They're all on board this global warming denying, fossil fuel binge, cut down the forests and pollute the rivers and to hell with conservation. We're going to make America, we're going to make ourselves rich again. And, you know, America, well, that's an afterthought.
Well, I think you know, I think with Pence, what you see is not just that Koch agenda, but also a bit of the sort of Handmaid's Tale, you know, incredible puritanical anti-gay, anti-women's reproductive rights agenda as well. And so that's also on the table here with these guys. But I think your assessment is right in the sense that where are the statesmen? Where are the men and women in Congress who would put country above party? And you have someone like McConnell who has routinely done the bidding of the Kochs and the carbon industry. You see Paul Ryan, who's been, you know, humiliated in some ways by Koch, but more than willing to do his bidding to get what he wants in terms of privatizing key components of our public system for, you know, whether it's Medicare, Social Security, or other key programs for our financial security. So you have a lot of people who are willing to use Trump to get what they want, which is a tremendous radical reactionary change in our country, despite the fact that a majority of people did not vote for Trump, voted for a different path, a path that was not this path of extremism. And yet you have members of Congress who are more than willing to go along with Trump in order to get their right-wing part of their part of the right-wing Koch agenda advanced.
Well, I guess Mike Pence has got the best of the both worlds. He can satisfy his patrons and they can get, I mean, the Kochs are incredibly rich. I think they're between the two of them, they're worth about $80 billion or something. I mean, they're just going to, are they trying to become richer than Bill Gates? Is that what this competition's about? Is this?
I don't know. Maybe they think that they can buy their way out of the devastating climate changes that are going to be becoming more manifest. I think this greed agenda is a disaster for us.
Right. I was going to say this is the 1% of the 1%'s penis measuring competition by the sound of it. You know, how many billions you can pile up. Meanwhile, of course, what Mike Pence has as an extra bonus is he has the righteousness of the Lord Jesus on his shoulder. You know, so to me that's...
Or so he claims. Right. Or so he claims. I think there are many people of faith who would disagree with his extremism.
I think that a part of being a Christian is to be a steward of this gift that God has given us, that they're about to befoul. I thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of ALEC Exposed and PR Watch. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, and as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into whether today's raising of the interest rate by the Fed could lead to more. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and the author of Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And the U.S. Federal Reserve today raised the interest rates for the first time in a year, and it seems like a pretty modest raise of, what, 0.25% increase from the rate to 0.75. Is anything that to get excited about? That's not suggesting that there's a trend, is there? That's just...
Well, you know, that's the big issue. The rate was about the least surprising thing, you know, in Washington this year. We've had a lot of surprising things. But, you know, everyone anticipated this. So the big question is, what's going to be the Fed's path going forward? And those of us who've been arguing on this, we've been, you know, many of the liberals, progressives have been saying, you know, look, you shouldn't be raising rates unless there's clear evidence of inflation. And I'm not happy about the quarter-point rate hike. I think it's a mistake, but the reality is a quarter-point rate hike doesn't have that much impact. What does have a lot of impact, if people think this can be followed through with another rate hike in January or March, and then another one after that, and another one after that, then you start seeing long-term rates rising. That means mortgage rates, that's rates on car loans. That will have a significant impact slowing the economy and stopping job creation. So from my perspective, we still have a lot of room to grow. There's a lot of people that are looking for jobs that could get jobs if the economy were stronger. Also, with the stronger labor market, workers are in a position to get wage gains. So, you know, workers in low-wage jobs in particular benefit from that. So I don't want to see the Fed raising rates. Again, the quarter point's not a real big deal. It's the wrong direction, but it's not that big a deal. The big issue is, what are they going to do going forward?
And what's the pressure then? Is there pressure in this new Trump administration to raise interest rates? Because isn't there a fear that if they push too hard, you could go into a recession?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is two things going on here. One, we have the current crew at the Fed. So their question is, how do they see the Trump administration? Trump's indicated he wants to have big tax cuts that will increase demand, increase growth in the economy, and increase employment, other things equal. Not the way to do it, because he's going to give it all to rich, or mostly to wealthy people. But in any case, it does increase demand. That's going to increase growth and put more pressure on the Fed to raise rates. Also, he's talked about infrastructure. Frankly, I don't know anyone has any idea of what he will actually put on the table for an infrastructure program. He's talked about this tax credit policy that's pretty crazy. I'm assuming he's not going to do it because it's just too kind of wacky. But in any case, you know, if we do have a lot of spending in infrastructure, that will also boost growth and, you know, again, might lead the Fed to raise rates more than otherwise would be the case. So that's, you know, just one question at current people on the Fed. But the other point is he's appointing people to the Fed. There's two vacancies. The Republicans would not approve people for President Obama, so he'd had two positions sit vacant. Yellen is up for reappointment next year. So Trump will be in a position either to reappoint her, I doubt he'll do that, or to pick her successor. So he has a big opportunity to influence what the Fed does. And whether he picks people who want to raise rates and they're worried about inflation, or whether he'll pick people who say, look, we should have growth, let's keep rates low, I really have no idea because he's argued both positions. So, you know, we're all kind of sitting here going, you know, we really don't know which direction he'll push the Fed. So, you know, answer, if the Fed does raise rates a lot, of course, that does risk slowing the economy to the point of pushing a recession. But whether it will, whether his people will want it to, I have no idea.
Well, one thing is clear, though, surely, Dean Baker, is that compared to the economy that Barack Obama was handed in 2009 when he took office, this economy couldn't be more different. And Donald Trump is pretty lucky in that regard, isn't he?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, in a certain sense, Obama was in a situation where you couldn't help but go up. The only question was how rapidly. So, you know, to say the economy is better in 2012 than it was in 2008, well, unless he had done something really awful, that was going to be true. And the fact that it's better in 2016 than it was in 2008, and for that matter, 2012, again, same story. When you inherit a very weak economy, it's easy to go up. Now, the question is, how do people see that? How do voters, you know, perceive that? You know, and a lot of people go, well, you know, things are bad. You know, this is certainly true in 2012, and a lot of people didn't vote for Obama because they said, you know, things are bad, and, you know, I blame the president. And, okay, you could do that, but the reality was things were real bad when he took office. And, you know, he certainly, no one could seriously thought he was going to turn things around on a dime. You know, the question was, did he do it fast enough? And, you know, arguable point. You know, it's not clear there was an easy path to do it better, but in any case, certainly, you know, there surely were paths to do it better. So, you know, in that sense, Obama benefited by, you know, it was easy to go up. It will be harder for Trump to go up, but in terms of, you know, are things better today than 2009? Hugely better. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, Obama inherits, you know, collapsing economy that's losing 700,000 jobs a month. The unemployment rate, you know, not too long into his term in office, hit 10%. And, you know, again, that was none of his doing. No one could blame him for that. That's what he walked into. So Trump has walked into, you know, a hugely better economy. But again, how he's perceived, you know, come 2018 elections, how he's perceived 2020 election, that's going to depend on what happens in the interim.
Well, there's no doubt that the U.S. stock market soared to record heights when following Trump's victory. But it fell slightly following today's decision. So what do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because, of course, a lot of people were writing about how the stock market didn't like Trump because every time there was good news for Clinton, the stock market seemed to go up. And when there was good news for Trump, it seemed to go down. Now, once he got in, there was an original downturn and then turned around and markets decided they're very happy with him. The markets are erratic. And to my view, I guess I'd say two things. First, just emphasizing that oftentimes the markets move for no really good reason. You know, they decide something's important and they go up a lot, or decide something's important and go down a lot. And a lot of these people have no clue. I mean, they just decide, oh, yeah, that's a good thing, that's a bad thing, and they react to it. Doesn't mean that that actually is a good thing or bad thing. The other point, though, is that even in principle, the market's not a measure of the economy. You know, we could look at, you know, we'll get our GDP number for the fourth quarter in January. That's a measure of the economy. You know, we have numbers like wage data. That's a measure of the economy. Job growth, that's, you know, measures of the economy. Stock market, in principle, is a measure of corporate profits. So one thing that would almost certainly send the stock market up, if they knew workers were going to get lower wages because Donald Trump's a friend of, you know, big business, and he's going to make sure that, you know, unions can't organize, workers will have to take pay cuts, that would likely put the stock market up. So No one should get the idea that, oh, great news, the stock market's up. I mean, if you own a lot of stock, you know, fine, you'll be happy about that. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything good for the country as a whole.
So what do you think went on in the meeting with all the Silicon Valley titans in the Trump Tower today, where obviously Peter Thiel is very much on board, the libertarian, but there are, you know, Apple CEO and others were there. Do you think there's some possibility of a repatriation of all that massive amount of money that Apple and other of these, you know, Google and these very, very profitable? I mean, Google is, of course, we should remind the audience, if you think Exxon's a big deal, Google has twice the market capitalization and a record amount of money sitting in the bank. I think $89 billion.
It's something like that. I have to say I'm not up to date on it, but certainly somewhere in that neighborhood. I think they will arrange a repatriation of some sort. Just to be clear, this is all a paper accounting thing. So this is often talked about like, oh, we're going to, you know, these companies, just as background, they have trillions of dollars in profits that they're keeping overseas. And as long as they're overseas, they don't have to pay profit on them. And the point that I would make is being overseas is largely an accounting fiction. So oftentimes they have their profits, you know, being, you know, in Europe or Japan or, you know, Bermuda, wherever it might be. And the money may actually be sitting in a bank in the United States. It's just registered to their subsidiary in Ireland or Bermuda or wherever. So it's not as though this is sometimes talked about like, oh, we're going to bring this money back and then they're all going to invest it. They would invest it now if they had good investment outlets. So this really is just silliness. Now, at some point, you know, they'll work a deal. They did this back in 2005. I'm sure they will work a deal where they say, okay, you can bring it back. The corporate tax rate, you know, ostensibly is 35%. No one pays that, but the average is about 22, 23. So you could bring it back, pay 5%, pay 10%. That's what they did back in 2005 was 5%. And, you know, and then, you know, we'll get something rather than nothing. I mean, 5% in my view is a real low number, but, you know, it does make sense to make some concession to get the money back. But, you know, they will probably do that. It will have no impact on the economy. It's not as though it will be an investment boom. And, again, having tried it once, we could say that with some authority because, you know, we could look at the data. There was no investment boom in 2005 when they brought the money back. You'd look really hard at the data to find any evidence of any impact on investment at all. So my guess is they will work something out like that because, you know, it's a way to get some amount of revenue. And the companies will be very happy. And, you know, you have a few people like me who are going, wait, you just gave them a big giveaway, you know. At the end of the day, they're going to carry the day.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And his latest book is Rigged, How Globalism and the Rules of a Market Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.